Welcome to Simoncast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I'm John Shaw, the director of the Institute. In Simoncast, we aim to keep the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well through wide-ranging civil conversations. We're delighted to be joined by Liz Alderman, who is the chief European business correspondent for the New York Times. Liz has an interesting background. She's from Northern Virginia, went to the University of Virginia, started out as an intern on Capitol Hill, moved into reporting, had some wonderful jobs covering Congress and the Federal Reserve. Then she was enticed to go to Europe for her company to help cover Europe, became the Paris bureau chief of Bridge News, went on to work for the International Herald Tribune, the New York Times back in New York, and then she returned to Europe to become the chief business correspondent based in Paris. And it might be worth saying, I mean, we're all focused on the elections, but this has been a massively consequential year or so in Europe. We had Chancellor Merkel, who left the scene after a long and important tenure. President Macron in France was reelected, although was challenged by a candidate who was once considered very far right, and she got 41% of the vote. And he had a difficult parliamentary election in June. There's been a hard right governments elected in both Sweden and in Italy. We've had three prime ministers in the UK in just the last year. And of course, the war in Ukraine has just fundamentally jolted European business, the European economy, and also has jolted the political scene in Europe. So there's probably no one better to talk about it than Liz. And I should say, in the spirit of full disclosure, Liz and I were fellow reporters in Washington in the 1990s and spent a lot of hours sitting through congressional hearings and standing outside tax negotiations. So it's delighted to see her again. And she's joining us from her home in Paris. So hello, Liz, and good afternoon for you.
Well, hello, John, and thank you so much for having me. It's really everything that you just ran through is certainly a blast from the past for me. As you said, you know, we actually knew one another and worked together in Washington, D.C., covering Congress. That was about, you know, 20 years ago before I moved here to Europe. I'm really delighted to join you from the New York Times bureau here in Paris, or right on the Champs-Élysées with the Arc de Triomphe outside. But yes, I mean, everything that you just sort of outlined has indeed meant that this has been a hugely consequential year. It's just been, a huge news cycle, and it's far from over.
Right. Well, let's start with your background, Liz. I mean, as I mentioned, you went to the University of Virginia. You grew up in Northern Virginia. You were telling me that you initially studied literature or languages, and then you kind of had a kind of unexpected foray into the world of business journalism. Talk a little bit about when you're leaving school, what your career aspirations were, and how you got on the path that you're on.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was at the University of Virginia, I, you know, had actually studied, you know, continental literature and language. I had also worked on my college newspaper, which I loved. But being hailing from, you know, being very near Washington, D.C., it had always been my dream to work on Capitol Hill. So I sort of started off right out of college with a couple of internships. The first one was actually working on the House Judiciary Committee, which at that time was headed by a very young Chuck Schumer, then representative. And then I also did an internship with then Senator Alphonse D'Amato. But, you know, I quickly sort of, you know, realized that, you know, I really was very, very interested in journalism. So I took sort of the first paying job that I could get, which was with a small tax newsletter to kind of get my foot in the door of the world of reporting. And although I was able to sort of, you know, start covering Congress a bit, my first assignment there was actually this very obscure assignment to go to the IRS and cover a hearing on the tax treatment of stripped bonds. And I said, what is that? I have no idea even what that is. But, you know, my job was to learn about it very quickly, to speak to experts, and most importantly, to then communicate what was going on in a way that average people could understand. So I've tried to do that ever since.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things about reporting is sometimes you're thrown into assignments in which you, as you say, you have no idea what a strip bond is. And so you have to sort of educate yourself into what the essence of the issue is.
you know, calling on experts and seeing what, if there's, you know, if there is a development, whether it's moving through legislation or rules or something. So one of the things about being a journalist, it's sort of a nonstop educational experience.
Exactly. And so, you know, having, you know, learned, obviously, sort of, you know, I learned a lot on the job. Eventually I moved on to Knight Ridder, the financial news agency, covering sort of the US economy, covering Congress. That's where you and I met. And also covering the Federal Reserve, following Alan Greenspan around, and also just getting a really wonderful sort of, you know, education in basically how the American economy works through all of that coverage. And also by talking to the top economists on Wall Street almost every day. And then in 1999, a new central bank was being created over here in Europe, the European Central Bank. And that's when I was asked by my company, which had been bought out and the name changed to Bridge News, to come over here and become the Paris Bureau Chief to help cover this really momentous development in the financial world, the creation of a new currency as well, which was basically meant, you know, the creation of the euro was basically intended to cement the post-war peace, you know, that had been achieved through economic union. And so that, you know, was fascinating. Europe is a big place. It's a very diverse place. Even though we do have the European Union, the countries, you know, there's a huge amount of solidarity. And yet at the same time, the countries all have their own agenda. And then, you know, we got Brussels sort of, you know, trying to lead it all. And it's, you know, it makes for sometimes, you know, rocky relationships between the various countries and leaders. And so anyway, after I got here started, you know, working, you know, helping with the coverage of what was going on here in Europe, I eventually moved to what was then the International Herald Tribune. They asked me to come on board and be their business editor, so I oversaw coverage of basically European economic and business issues there. At that time, the paper was jointly owned by the New York Times and the Washington Post. And when the New York Times took over full ownership, they asked me to become the business editor. So I went to New York and I worked on the business desk as an editor. And that was around 2008. I got there right before Lehman Brothers fell. So it was a very momentous time, obviously. You know, a huge financial crash in the United States and around the world with repercussions that lasted a very long time and that affected not only businesses, but, you know, people in ways that, you know, ricocheted for quite a while. And after a couple of years of doing that, the Times then asked me to come back over here to Paris and to become the European business correspondent, economics, covering economics, and basically coming back here because at that time, a couple of years after Lehman fell, the euro crisis broke out. And so, you know, I put my bags down in my Paris apartment and I jumped on the first plane to Ireland, which was basically sort of the first crack in the euro union and, you know, covered sort of how the financial crisis was unfolding there, then to Portugal, then on to Greece, and, you know, eventually to pretty much every European country that, you know, had fallen into crisis. And, you know, along the way, you know, again, you know, sort of what I try to focus on is, you know, trying to tell the story of these massive economic trends that are happening, as well as the impact of policies that are made kind of, you know, behind closed doors, the impact of all that on real people and on real businesses. And my coverage has therefore taken me, you know, I focus heavily as much as possible on the sort of social impact of all of this. And my coverage also led me to, my reporting also led me to cover things like the migrant crisis, the refugee crisis, as, you know, tens of thousands of migrants, you know, were coming through Greece and making their way through Europe. Here in Paris, I've also covered things as varied as, you know, also, you know, terrorism attacks, the attacks on the Charlie Hebdo offices, as well as the ISIS attacks in Paris. And so all of these things continue to sort of, you know, have echoes even today. And now we have, you know, a war in Europe's backyard. And that is something that is truly looming huge and that is sort of focused all attention on this side of the Atlantic.
Right. I want to turn to that in just a second. I wonder just a couple questions on the mechanics of how the New York Times covers Europe, because as you said, there's 28 countries in the EU. I know you have colleagues spread throughout Europe. How do you coordinate stories? I mean, do you have like a weekly conference call? How do you sort of decide what to run after? Obviously, there's breaking events. There are more feature stories. How does this shape your coverage?
So here in Europe, our main editing office is in London. And there's, you know, two desks. There's the covering, you know, foreign affairs. There's, you know, the foreign desk as well as the business desk. I am attached to the business desk. And so, you know, the European, you know, business correspondents will get together, you know, once a week. We have a conference call where we talk about what each one of us is covering and also what we see as kind of, you know, the major stories ahead. The same thing, you know, happens on the foreign desk. And then the two desks try as best they can to, you know, coordinate with one another. Because, of course, a lot of economic developments have political implications and vice versa. But we generally, you know, talk to one another most of the time. You know, so that the right hand knows what the left is doing, in order to provide as much in-depth coverage as we can of developments.
Well, let's talk for a second about the New York Times in Europe, because obviously it's a hugely prestigious newspaper. Do you find that you have good access to European leaders? Do doors come flying open? Do they require a little bit of knocking and nudging? I mean, talk about how the New York Times is perceived in Europe and what sort of access that gives or limits you.
That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, being able to sort of use the New York Times name when you're knocking on a door certainly opens a lot of doors. And one thing that I noticed in different countries is that whenever we write a story about that country, it then winds up being sort of all over the local media. The New York Times reported this about, you know, France or Greece or Spain or Ireland or what have you, Hungary, you know, for example. So, you know, there's, and I think, you know, that what we can bring to the coverage of different countries is, not only a kind of a step back perspective, a 30,000 foot perspective, but also a lot more neutrality than what the local press can bring. And often, you know, one of the comments that we often hear is, I had to read about what's happening in the New York Times. And, you know, at the same time, it's interesting because, you know, in the United States, when a scandal has happened or if some wrongdoing has been uncovered, you know, by investigative journalism, let's say, you know, I don't know, bribes or flouting of you know, campaign finance laws or, you know, issues like that, you know, usually it becomes a pretty big deal. And the person that is in the spotlight, their feet are held to the fire. One difference that I notice is that that's not necessarily so much the case here in Europe. And for example, you know, there's been situations here in France where one of the former presidents, you know, he's under investigation for illegal, you know, campaign, you know, financing. That's something that we wrote about, you know, heavily. But nothing kind of really ever came of it. So that's one thing that I do find a little bit curious about Europe is that they don't seem to be kind of holding people's feet to the fire as much as is the case in the United States. And furthermore, in Brussels, the whole lobbying scene is just really opaque. It's very hard to follow a money trail here. You really have to dig very hard to know sort of, you know, who's sort of greasing the money wheels in order to find out what influence has been brought to bear behind different regs and legislation that come forward. So those are a couple of big differences with the United States in terms of coverage.
Okay. Well, let's talk about France. And President Macron was reelected this spring. We kind of forget that in 2017, when he was first elected, it was, as I recalled, as a, you know, an economic reformer, a modernizer, someone who kind of broke through the traditional molds and was going to kind of re-energize France. He also talked a lot about having a more independent Europe. This was during the Trump years, so he talked about European sovereignty. And so talk about the sort of the promise of Macron and what he seemed to be when he was first elected in 2017.
Yeah, I mean, Macron is, I mean, he's a very extraordinary character in the sense that he kind of came out of nowhere. He had not been on the political scene. He was not at all a professional politician. As a matter of fact, at one point, he was going to become a philosopher. Because he had studied philosophy and one of the theses that he did was actually on Machiavelli. And he worked with the renowned French philosopher, Paul Ricoeur. But he was also a very ambitious person. I had met him and interviewed him several times. I did a big profile of him when he was the economy minister under President Hollande. And he was definitely sort of the most Anglo-Saxon style economy of anybody in the cabinet, to the point where he riled a lot of people in François Hollande's, you know, own party in the Socialist Party, which has since done terribly. Macron is a pro-business president. He basically kind of came to power in a sort of almost Obama-esque way. Basically calling for hope. The parties that had been ruling France for many, many years, you know, voters had lost faith in them, and they decided to put their faith in somebody new. And so what he did, what his promise was that if we massage the French economy to allow it to create jobs more easily. His idea was because France is, as you may know, has a very heavy social safety net. So when people get, you know, Elon Musk just fired, you know, half of Twitter, and basically with the message saying, you know, don't come back to work tomorrow. You couldn't do that in a country like France. France has a huge amount of protections. Which are, you know, for historical reasons. It has a very generous, you know, education, you know, healthcare. People in France and businesses pay very high taxes in order to fund the social safety net. And so what that means is that when people eventually do lose their jobs, they don't fall through the cracks. But what it also means is that the economy here is not nearly as dynamic as it is in the United States. It's very hard to fire people, and therefore employers are reluctant to hire. And so, you know, Macron's kind of big bang idea was that he would come in and he would rework the most rigid parts of the French labor code in order to make the economy more dynamic. And that's kind of worked a little bit. He's made it a little bit easier for employers to downsize, for example, when the company, you know, falls into sort of, you know, financial trouble. Yet at the same time, you know, the culture of the country is such that people do demand protectionism. So the government, what we've noticed under Macron is that, you know, at the same time, the government comes in and very heavily subsidizes companies or will intervene to try and prevent the closure of factories. And things like that. But what is kind of happening now, especially in the wake of COVID, is that France, as well as other countries, are talking about they want reindustrialization. They want to reverse globalization. They want to bring all these jobs back that have gone overseas over so many years, because millions of jobs have been lost in France due to globalization. Whether Macron can actually sort of, you know, make that happen, I think it's going to be an uphill battle, especially now that we have, you know, with Russia's war on Ukraine, it's sent energy prices, you know, sky high, and it's just sort of an event that, if anything, is creating sort of, you know, more problems for Macron, in the sense that, these and other factors are also widening a kind of inequality divides in this country. And what's happening in France is also, being seen to a certain degree in other large Western European countries. So Macron does have, a difficult task, as you pointed out. He was reelected, in a really tough fight with Marine Le Pen, who was his challenger in the first election. This time it was much closer. Macron himself has lost a lot of support because since he was first elected, he has tacked much more to the right, as we've seen, in the United States and in several other European countries. There's more and more kind of division happening in France, a little bit like what we see in the United States these days too. So he definitely has a challenge, in the time that he had, in the several years that he has remaining in his presidency.
Well, in your writing, you do point that shortly, I think a year or two into his presidency, there was this big backlash called the Yellow Vest Movement that had begun, I guess, initially as a reaction to a fuel tax increase, but then morphed into something larger. And I want to read a couple sentences that you wrote. You said, the Yellow Vest rallies in 2018 highlighted in stark and sometimes violent fashion the risk of losing political buy-in from citizens who are faced with rising costs to drive cars, heat homes, and run appliances. And you later said that, that this movement morphed into a collective outcry over deeper problems that have plagued France for years: declining living standards and eroding purchasing power. Has that movement, which I think originated in central France, then mushroomed, is that movement still in some sense kind of in the back burner?
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because the Yellow Vest movement, was sort of left a huge imprint on, on the French psyche, and it did expose these fault lines that I describe in my coverage. One of the problems, by the way, too, is that Macron, people felt that he kind of push things a little bit too far, that he was trying to make the economy too liberal. And so, when he originally proposed, increasing a gas tax, this was seen as basically the equivalent of, the elites in Washington, pushing this legislation that's going to have an impact in, rural Kansas, that they haven't bothered to sort of, think through. And so there was this, backlash that basically sort of happened to a president who they perceived as having become very quickly out of touch with what was happening on the ground. So, what happened was that, Macron did quickly try to do a lot of things to appease people. He backed off on that policy, which, by the way, was a policy aimed at trying to improve the environment. But setting that aside, one of the things that came out of that was, the question of, well, is it only rich people who can afford to help with this big environmental transition? In any case, things have not flared up terribly in the last, year and a half or so, but there's still a lot simmering under the surface here in France. And we've seen protests recently. The Yellow Vests is not gone. They are less sort of, active and powerful than they were before. But that being said, we are starting to see protests again here in France, as well as in some other European countries, once again, over rising energy prices and the loss of purchasing power, as we face now record high inflation in Europe. Inflation is over 10% now. So the government here is spending billions, has spent more than 80 billion trying to, subsidize people's, energy bills, give discounts at the gas pump and things like that. But that can only go on so long. And so one of the things that a lot of people are waiting to see is, at some point, when the government, eases up on all of these subsidies, is more discontent going to break out onto the streets, which then could possibly, the concern goes, have possibly an impact on overall support for Ukraine here in Europe.
Well, Liz, you mentioned inflation, and you wrote a terrific story recently called Bread Prices Skyrocket as Inflation Grips Europe. And it's a terrific article. You reported it from a family flour mill in central France. And you're just talking about their struggles to produce bread, you know, when all these other external costs are pushing up, you know, pressuring them. And so you say, you know, you write, as inflation continues to flare across Europe, few matters are causing more concern than the cost of a basic loaf. When the price of bread rises, people feel it right away. First of all, talk about how you found bread as kind of a metaphor or as kind of an example to get at the broader issue of inflation, and a little bit about the story itself that was really well written and very interesting.
Well, thank you so much for that. You know, I mean, when we're writing about issues like, you know, inflation or growth or, you know, recession, you know, it's, these terms can sometimes be eye glazing, right? And so we're writing a lot of stories about this, you know, as inflation develops. And, you know, at some point, you really want to try and, you know, storify this in a way that, you know, a lot of people can understand. And I think kind of everybody can understand that, you know, bread is the most basic thing that we buy. You know, in Africa and in Egypt, you know, there have been even some small riots, you know, because bread has become unaffordable. That's not yet the case in Europe, but yet inflation has spiked so high that the way I kind of got turned on to this story was that Eurostat, which is Europe's statistics agency, put out a kind of a special report highlighting the fact that the price of bread had shot to record highs in every country, mainly because of Russia's war in Ukraine, the impact that it had on the price of grains, as well as on energy prices. And basically, you know, in Hungary, the price of bread has spiked more than 70% in 1 year, which is astounding. And in all of the, so kind of looking at, you know, all the countries where bread prices had spiked the most, a lot of them are the sort of East European countries that are pretty close to Ukraine, that had previously been very heavily dependent, you know, on Russian gas, which has now been, you know, mostly kind of cut off. And also the fact that, you know, Ukraine is sort of one of the major breadbaskets of the world, the fact that grain was not getting out of there. And I had been in Ukraine, you know, a couple of months earlier, doing a lot of economic reporting there. I had gone out into the fields, these, you know, with farmers, and they were all talking about, you know, how they couldn't get their grain out at the time and how they were not going to be able to plant for a big harvest, you know, this in the coming year. All of that, you know, creating, you know, food emergencies, basically. And so I just was fascinated that, you know, Eurostat put out a special report on bread, because they kind of never do that. So I started to look into it. And yeah, I found basically in France, you know, I decided to set it in France, even though France is not one of the countries where the bread price had risen the most. It had risen almost 10%, which is less than 70%. But nonetheless, bread is incredibly important symbolically here in France. It's one of the reasons why the French Revolution broke out, was over the price of bread or the inaccessibility of bread. And so, you know, I wound up basically, I called a local restaurant owner who I know, you know, to ask him where did he get his bread. And from there, a bunch of different phone calls led to this owner of this flour mill, whose story really sort of encapsulated everything that I just mentioned, the dynamics of Russia cutting off the gas to Europe, because his bill to run the machinery to grind the grain into wheat had jumped from 50,000 euros a month 1 year ago to, starting in January, the bill will be 200,000 euros a month. And, you know, he was having to, also he was concerned because they keep track of what's going on in Ukraine. The grain is not getting out as well as it had been. And so all of this had led him to, you know, warn the bakeries that he supplies to make French bread that, that they were that he was going to have to raise prices, and that they very likely would have to do that too, which means it's going to be passed on to consumers. And it was just an interesting way of sort of showing, you know, how all of that ripples through the economy. Something that's happening far away ripples throughout the economy and hits the consumer, and causes a big problem.
Right. Well, another terrific story you wrote recently, it's called Turtlenecks and Warmest Showers: France Seeks to Weather an Energy Crisis. And read a couple sentences and have you talk about it. You say, life in France will soon get a little chillier. Thermostats turn down to 19 degrees Celsius, 66 degrees Fahrenheit. Cooler showers in homes and hotels. No hot water in the bathrooms of public buildings. In the City of Light, the Eiffel Tower will go dark early. The French government on Thursday unveiled its biggest energy conservation measures since the 1970s oil crisis. Part of the Europe-wide effort to save power this winter is Russia shuts off natural gas supplies to countries that support Ukraine. And then you go on to talk about some of the symbolic things where President Macron, who's usually a suit and tie guy, is now wearing a lot of black turtlenecks and just trying to convey, frankly, some images that Jimmy Carter with his cardigan kind of embraced in the 1970s. So talk about just this, the way inflation is, and particularly the energy aspect of it, is causing both a focus on increasing supplies and also a whole spate of conservation measures.
So, I mean, this, you know, the energy crisis that has broken out because of Russia's war in Ukraine is really the biggest thing to happen to Europe in a very long time. And it has spurred, subsequent to that story, I did another story, a kind of a bigger step back piece with one of my colleagues, sort of taking a look at the massive efforts that Europe is making, really by kind of banding together. I mean, there's still infighting between various countries over the details of how to do things. But basically, what Europe has tried to do is to kind of, you know, band together to try and set aside enough, you know, gas supplies to get Europe through this winter, through its first winter without Russian gas. Russia was the biggest supplier of gas to Europe. And, you know, thanks to Russian gas, you know, the German economy was, you know, a kind of a behemoth. The German economy relied the most on Russian gas of any other country. And thanks to that, you know, it could became sort of a manufacturing, you know, powerhouse. Now suddenly it's, you know, doesn't sort of have all that gas anymore. And similarly, you know, here in France, there's been some troubles as well with the French nuclear program. France is actually the biggest producer of nuclear electricity on the continent. However, since the beginning of the year, they've had a massive crisis in their nuclear fleet, and half the fleet is offline. Really, it's like couldn't come at a worse possible time. So there's been this confluence of events. And yet, you know, what Europe has done is sort of moved with what, you know, seems to be lightning speed, at least for Europe, to try and sort of, you know, plant the seeds for let's get through this winter. And let's set things up so that in the future, we will be pretty much almost completely independent of Russian energy. And so, you know, I mean, what that means in terms of supply is that in the short term, Europe has negotiated a bunch of contracts to get, you know, imports of liquefied natural gas in from the United States. This year became the biggest supplier, one of the biggest suppliers of liquefied natural gas being shipped over from there to Europe. Europe has also inked new contracts with countries like Algeria and Qatar. I mean, the problem is that a lot of those are going to take, you know, time to be put into place. So in the meantime, what we've seen is that Europe also doesn't have enough infrastructure to get all of that gas in. Right now, there's several dozen tankers sitting off of the coast of Spain that are filled with liquefied natural gas that can't dock, because there's not sort of enough infrastructure to welcome them, and B, Europe rushed so much to fill up its underground supply tanks, which are kind of honeycombed all over Europe in these sort of underground caves. Those are mostly full now. So now there's like nowhere else to store the gas. And at the same time, you know, what's happened is that Europe has also been turning back to dirty energy, to coal, to fuel oil, to diesel and things like that. And so, you know, that's also having the effect of setting back a very ambitious European policy, which is to basically kind of transition to a green economy. But at the same time, it has lit a fire under businesses and politicians to speed up as much as they can an already fairly significant implementation of clean energy, so wind, you know, and solar. So the idea is to basically kind of, you know, like I said, sort of, you know, just get us through this winter, continue to build up alternate you know, clean energy sources. And, you know, there's probably going to be some stumbling, especially sort of next year, depending on what happens with, you know, gas prices and gas supply. But the longer term view is that this will, it's an event that is sort of pushing Europe to become much more energy independent. And in tandem with that, Europe in general has also launched its biggest energy conservation movement since the oil crisis. So all across the continent, you know, households and businesses are all being asked to turn their thermostats down, turn their hot water heaters down, to turn off streetlights and lighting on museums and things like that, you know, early. Even in Finland, people are being asked to take, you know, saunas together who don't know each other kind of thing. So the idea is that if you can ratchet down consumption collectively while building up or trying to secure the supplies, then yeah, we should be able to make it.
Yeah, and I read in one of your pieces, you're talking in Slovakia, they're encouraged to cook with microwaves rather than stoves, to have one glass of water when they brush their teeth. I mean, all sorts of things. And then you were very playful in your reference to the Finnish saunas, saying that they want them to have fewer ones, have it a little bit cooler, and then not a lot of guidance as to whether they should have group saunas unclothed.
I'm sure they'll figure that out themselves. Right. But what's impressive is that people in Europe sort of seem to understand that what's happening here is quite extraordinary, and people understand that basically they have to band together. And one thing that we think that Putin, you know, has been counting on is that at some point, if people get too cold, if people, you know, his bills get too high, that there will be a backlash against politicians, which could possibly undermine sort of European solidarity towards Ukraine. So far, that has not really happened. And we've been spared so far by very mild weather. So, you know, it's definitely a gamble. It's a gamble that he's taking.
Right. Well, another piece that you wrote that I think is both a specific issue, but a kind of a broader theme, was called Self-Checkout in France Sets Off Battle Over Day of Rest. And as you tell in the article, that the tradition in France for many, many years was that employees, you know, would stop working at 1 o'clock on Sunday, places would effectively shut down. And then there was a move, at least in a few stores, to have automated cashiers, which kind of shattered this taboo. And then it kind of raised the broader question of how technology might affect jobs going forward. In the article, you quote a union official saying, if automated cashiers become normalized, it'll have a catastrophic impact on workers. And then you further poignantly quote a woman who I think for 30 years or so had worked in a department store, who said, even if we give them flexibility, they will always ask for more. All the social achievements we work for are collapsing like a house of cards. So talk about that specific story. I mean, what piqued your interest and then the broader issues that it tackles?
So, you know, one of the issues that I cover in Europe is jobs and what is happening with jobs. And, you know, the way that technology and automation is sort of, you know, impacting people's livelihood and society. And what piqued my interest was that you know, France is a place where there is always a lot of protests in France, which I think is something that goes all the way back to sort of, you know, the revolution, and sort of, you know, this idea that people really do need to fight for their rights. And so, in that particular story, it sort of, you know, highlighted this phenomenon that had hit a nerve here in France, but that also, has been rippling throughout, you know, other economies in Europe and certainly in the United States. And that is basically, is my job going to be taken away by a robot? What was happening in these supermarkets here was that cashiers and unions were protesting against the automated checkout, the idea of self checkout, because what it basically means is that, you know, it would allow the supermarket to, you know, lay off a pretty sizable chunk of its workforce. And then what happens to the people whose jobs are lost? Well, in an ideal world, you know, they would be protected, you know, with a certain amount of unemployment and be retrained for, you know, other jobs. But it's not that easy. And because the French economy is not so dynamic, you know, it doesn't always sort of, you know, work out that way. So basically the story sort of encapsulated this kind of, you know, tug of war that's going on where, you know, you have companies that, you know, that want to sort of improve efficiency, obviously sort of, you know, improve their, you know, returns. And one of the ways to do that is through automation. But the downside to that is the impact to human lives, especially in an economy where there's not enough dynamism to quickly create new jobs for people at the bottom. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen is, again, that, you know, income inequality, even in France, with all of its sort of, you know, social support, has widened. This is an issue that's not going away. And I just thought it was an interesting way to encapsulate sort of one facet of it through that particular story.
Right. You did another really interesting story, I think, a few years earlier about this pressure on the middle class. I think you actually reported it from Madrid. And you, at the top of the story, you profile a couple that had, as I recall, had been doing pretty well. You know, their jobs were either downsized or cut back. And so they went from, you know, really quite comfortable circumstances to really quite pressed financially. And you quote the woman, her name is Raquel, saying, "We're the people who've worked our way up and now we're tumbling down. We're the forgotten ones." And then I think she later refers to herself as the invisibles. Talk about that story and then the broader issue about this squeeze on middle income people, both in France and Spain and other parts of Europe, and just how that's affecting political developments.
So, yeah, I mean, it was very interesting. This is, I did go to Spain for that story because in Spain had been painted as a success story. In the wake of the 2010 financial crisis, it took a long time for European economies to recover. But one of the ways, and so eventually when they did, one of the main indicators for that is, you know, a falling unemployment rate, which is usually pretty good news. A country like Spain always had a kind of a high unemployment rate, but it had fallen to supposedly, you know, a very low number. But when you look behind the numbers, what you saw was that the jobs that were being created were sort of incredibly precarious. When jobs were sort of being destroyed, also there were not good jobs for people who had lost work to kind of, you know, go back into. It was all jobs that just pushed, you know, people kind of lower down the ladder. So when they had fallen, they couldn't really get back up. And that was the case with this couple, this woman. She used to own her own business. The husband, you know, used to work at, you know, a big company. He was like, her job, and, you know, they had saved money She tried everything she could to get another job. I can't remember how long she looked, a very long time. And eventually, I think it was after a year and a half, wound up getting a job as a secretary after running her own business, getting a job as a secretary at a consulting company, which was on a temporary contract where she was basically making minimum wage, but she was basically giving legal advice, right, to other company, you know, to other people that were coming in who were trying to run their own business. So she was, a secretary in title and in salary, but was, you know, doing this much higher level job. And at the same time, at some point, you know, their money just ran out because the job that the husband was able to get after that, I think, if I remember correctly, he wound up finding the only thing he could find was working as a butcher. They just didn't have money to pay the rent, pay the mortgage anymore on what had been, you know, this middle class, you know, lifestyle. And there had been a lot of data that had come out that had been published recently by, for example, by the ECB, by the International Labor Organization, basically talking about how one of the major consequences of the financial crisis was the hollowing out of the European middle class. So what was happening in Spain was a very hard story, but mirrored certainly in other countries. And, you know, one of the things, the political reverberations that we've seen from that is disenchantment with kind of, you know, sort of liberal, you know, liberal-minded, you know, economics, neoliberal economics was, you know, increasingly sort of, you know, blamed for a lot of these problems. And I'll just say that sort of, you know, in this most recent election, presidential election here in France, one reason why Marine Le Pen did so well is because she traveled the country and went to small towns and cities and listened to people talk mostly about their concern that they were losing purchasing power, that they were losing work, that they were not able to kind of, you know, make ends meet anymore, that they saw no way of being able to climb up from, you know, the bottom, basically. And she listened to them and she made them feel like they were heard. And that's also, you know, something that had happened in Greece a number of years ago with then far right group Golden Dawn. You know, in Italy, we've just seen the elections that you pointed to. One of the major concerns there as well is about purchasing power. I mean, not only obviously sort of immigration is also a huge issue here in Europe, but, you know, this is what has happened with, you know, the sort of, you know, economic stratification of societies definitely has an influence on the political developments that we're seeing here.
Liz, we had a question emailed in about asking about Brexit and its economic implications for Europe. And we have it, obviously, it's had profound effect on the UK and its politics and its economics. But to the extent that you can generalize, do most of Europe say, okay, it's sort of a done deal and we're going to move on? Or what are the economic repercussions of Brexit in Europe?
Well, thanks for bringing up Brexit, because I mean, that is also obviously sort of the other huge, you know, story that's happened here in Europe in the last several years. You know, basically, I think if I can start with sort of the present moment, you know, a lot of Europe has been looking at what's been happening in the UK, you know, three prime ministers in a very short period of time, and kind of the chaos that has come down there, and said sort of a little bit, see, we told you so. That might not have been a great idea, you know, after all. You know, I would say, you know, in Britain itself, you know, the promise was that Brexit would make, you know, Britain a kind of a brighter place, you know, economically. Mainly the issue was that they wouldn't have, you know, a lot of immigrants, and particularly immigrant labor, you know, coming in to take jobs. And also the other thing was that Britain would not have to sort of pay sort of the huge dues that all countries have to pay basically to be a member of the European Union, which are paid to Brussels. And then Brussels sets these kind of pan-European regulations that all countries have to adhere to. And a lot of people didn't like that in Britain, whether it was, you know, fishermen regarding fishing quotas or construction industry or what have you. But overall, I mean, it certainly does seem like Britain is at least this far out is not better off for that. And really, I mean, the country that seems to have been hurt most by this is Britain itself. I mean, I have, you know, friends who live there, you know, outside of London, who tell me that some of their supermarket shelves are kind of, you know, slightly empty. Some of the like products that they used to be able to get easily, you know, from other countries, no longer kind of come in, for example. In the case of, you know, companies like, you know, Airbus makes, they have a factory in Britain that makes sort of, you know, airplane wings. And, you know, the wing has to go kind of back and forth between the British and French border, you know, several times before it's completed. You know, that was a huge concern because that just, you know, isn't as easy as it used to be. But I think, you know, what with this most recent situation where, you know, you had the previous Prime Minister Liz Truss, you know, come in and press this, you know, agenda that just basically wound up sort of, you know, tanking everything, this kind of tone deaf, you know, agenda that now has put Britain even more into a hole, because we're seeing, you know, the central bank having to jack up interest rates. We're seeing pension funds losing money. We're also, you know, seeing basically Britain become a much less attractive place for people to want to go and work. So, you know, they're going to have to get through a really tough period, we think, before things start to look bright again.
Liz, I saw you on a panel and you were talking a little bit about the European business stance, or maybe political stance too, towards China. And you made the point that whereas in the United States, we seem to be in kind of a confrontational mode with China, that Europe's approach, to the extent, again, you can generalize, is more of an engagement. Talk about how European political and business leaders view the emergence of China as a really powerful superpower, and also some of its, you know, moves away from any kind of openness to a much more one man rule political system.
Well, certainly China is viewed as, you know, a very important economic, you know, factor, you know, here in Europe. A lot of countries, we just saw, you know, Olaf Scholz, the leader of Germany, go over there to a great deal of criticism, by the way, because, you know, the German economy is hurting and, you know, Germany basically still needs China to sell its Mercedes and BMWs to. I mean, generally speaking, you know, the Bruno Le Maire, the French finance minister, when I interviewed him recently, you know, was talking about sort of this different approach, you know, between, you know, that the United States and that Europe have, but which is, as you point out, sort of, you know, more of a kind of engagement. But with this most recent party meeting in China, where the president very clearly and very significantly consolidated his power even more, that has sent ripples of concern throughout Europe. So, you know, one of the reason why a lot of European leaders were unhappy that the German leader decided to go over there on his own is because some of them wanted to be able to go over there, you know, all together to kind of send a message to China that, you know, this makes us highly uncomfortable, this will not stand. But at the same time, Europe still wants to do business with China. So it's a pretty tricky situation. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, however, that, you know, the European economy is headed into a recession as much as is possible. Companies want to be able to sell to China, and they also need a number of imports from China to keep, you know, various, you know, factories running. So, you know, there's a message. The message of concern is being sent, but there's not any sort of inclination to sort of, you know, start a trade war with China.
Right. Well, Liz, as we wind down, a couple of kind of broad questions. I mean, we have students who are on and they're probably looking at you and saying, OK, you know, Paris correspondent, New York Times, you know, how do I sign up? I mean, more broadly, what kind of advice would you give for students who are interested in careers in journalism? Yeah, I mean, you talked earlier, we both talked a little bit offline about how both, you know, in both of our cases, it was a little bit of ad hoc and sort of making it up on the fly. But what have you learned in your career that you would maybe pass on to students?
One thing that I would say is that, you know, definitely if you, you know, want to get into journalism, you have to come to it with a lot of energy and with a lot of curiosity, and also with kind of a desire to, you know, be able to sort of, you know, figure out ways of telling an important story in ways that will resonate, you know, with a large audience, especially when it comes to business reporting or economics reporting. These things can be very dry. But, you know, if you sort of do it in the right way, I think, you know, it's very important to sort of humanize the reporting whenever possible. And to also, you know, speak truth to power. Because, you know, a lot of what we see coming out of political leaders, policymakers, CEOs is obviously, you know, a certain spin on things. And, you know, our job is to go in and, you know, pull back the curtain and see what's really behind it. Why is it that in France a couple of years ago, you know, hundreds of babies got salmonella poisoning because of milk that was coming out of one of the world's largest sort of, you know, powdered milk producers that's based here in France. Well, as it turns out, you know, the company did a great deal of lobbying along with some other companies that are in the same business behind closed doors. Very difficult to sort of, you know, find out the money trail, but they, you know, a lot of regulations were sort of changed in ways that favored the company so that there were not as many health inspections, for example. I mean, these are stories that need to be told. You know, who is still doing business in Russia despite all of these sanctions? You know, that's important as well. And so just kind of, you know, trying to sort of figure out ways to, I would say, you know, follow the money trail is always a good way to go because there's a lot behind, you know, behind that, behind the money that, you know, people don't see. And I mean, the other thing that I would say is that, John, when you and I sort of started off, you know, the media industry was a different place. At that time, you could still get actually sort of, you know, a job with an actual kind of contract, you know, and things like that, and, you know, make a pretty solid career in it. And, you know, the landscape has changed dramatically since you and I, you know, started off. It's harder to get a job these days, in media, or a lot of jobs might be kind of, you know, freelance jobs, and people are kind of, you know, trying to sort of, you know, make their way, you know, through that. So that can certainly be more difficult. But at the same time, you know, if you have a passion for it, there's a lot of different news outlets that didn't exist when we were just starting, investigative, you know, websites and things like that that are funded by foundations, and they all do very meaningful work. So I would encourage people to look into that as well. And you know, always the most important thing is to follow your passion, because if you do, then you are going to wind up succeeding, even if the road getting there is a tough one.
Well, and even in your case, when you talk about beginning covering, you know, obscure tax policy and being thrown into highly arcane topics that you really had no background and yet had to battle through and learn the issue and make it presentable. And so, you know, so your first job won't be at the New York Times, probably. It will be with, you know, tax notes or something like that. And you can learn really on any job and any kind of reporting opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, of course, you know, it's the most important thing is to sort of, you know, get your foot in the door and to learn as much as you can. You know, try to get yourself partnered with seasoned reporters. You know, read widely. Read not only, you know, what happens to be kind of you know, within your own political viewpoint, but, you know, read outside of that, read magazines, read the way that people write, read investigative stories. You will see, if you study them, basically how the reporters, you know, managed to pull this together, what their sources were, the people, you know, that they talked to, and just, you know, knock on doors. There's a lot of cold calling as well. But, you know, again, it's like, you know, you do have to have sort of the stamina and the determination. But, you know, the world is changing very, very quickly. And one of the things that we hear a lot about is that people feel that there's information overload. Well, making your story stand out is a major way of trying to kind of get past that and keep people engaged at a time when the news cycle is just, you know, moving so fast. And also tends to be sort of, you know, very editorialized. If you, you know, have a good story to tell, if you can uncover something that's meaningful for people, you know, they will gravitate to it.
Great. Well, Liz, thank you so much for a terrific conversation. I know you're taking a quick trip to the U.S. for a high school reunion, I think, this weekend. Yes. But when you come back another time for a longer visit, we'd love to entice you to the university and maybe speak with students and civic groups and just kind of get a sense of what's happening in this part of the world. And let me end on this note. I mean, as someone, an American in Europe, I mean, I'm sure people are constantly saying to you, so what's going on in the United States? Tell us just for a moment about what the European perspective is on the United States, to the extent that you can generalize over, you know, a couple dozen countries and so forth. But what questions as an American are you asked most frequently by your European friends and colleagues?
The number one question that I am asked is, can Donald Trump get elected again? That's the number one thing that people want to know. They want to know, and you know, if so, how and why? You know, what is happening to the United States? Why is the sort of division that's come so, you know, painfully out into the open over the last, several years? Is that kind of here to stay? Is the United States headed for, you know, a civil war? These are concerns that people have. I think those questions are just going to grow, you know, depending on what we see this week. So,
yeah, I was talking before the 2020 election, presidential election, to a Swedish diplomat. And I said, so what do you think about the election? And he said, I think it's the most important election in Sweden's history. Giving a sense of just the importance of the United States, even as our economic strength declines and our political institutions are under threat and under pressure. But there is this deep sense, really, that it's an important force in the world, and its evolution is intensely important.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, every leader here in Europe, you know, basically feels that way. I mean, the United States is very, very important. I mean, the United States is still sort of the first mover and shaker in the world. For example, you know, we've got a war in our backyard here. People are pretty worried about whether, you know, we might see a nuclear explosion somewhere not too far, you know, from our borders. You know, people are very worried about whether the incoming Congress might decide to back off on support for Ukraine, for example, and sort of, you know, what would that mean in terms of, you know, the conflict that we're seeing here. But even beyond that, you know, what the United States does, you know, vis-a-vis China, for example, whatever the next president does vis-a-vis China or this Congress, vis-a-vis, you know, trade, it's hugely important. So I would have to say that those words that the Swedish diplomat, you know, uttered to you is exactly what's running through the minds of every European leader here right now.
Great. Well, Liz, thank you again for a really terrific conversation. It's great to be back in touch after just a few years. And as I say,
my pleasure.
Yeah, and I'd love to entice you to Southern Illinois when you're back in the U.S. for a longer stay and show you the region and, again, have you meet with students and talk about your fine work for the New York Times.
Well, John, thank you so much. And that is an invitation that I cannot refuse. So thank you. I will hold you to it.
Okay, great.
Thank you for listening to SimonCast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. Simoncast is produced in collaboration with WSIU Public Radio. You can find Simoncast wherever you listen to podcasts, including NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe to new episodes as soon as they're posted and tell your friends about our show. For more information, visit paulsimoninstitute.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you for keeping the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well.